This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane. With Australia's east coast in the grip of an energy crisis, the new federal minister, Energy Minister Chris Bowen, will today meet his state and territory counterparts to discuss potential solutions. The boss of one of Australia's biggest energy companies is warning there are no easy fixes, but ministers might want to look west for longer-term solutions. Energy reporter Daniel Mercer explains.
Jeff Dimery has been around the energy industry long enough to know when times are extraordinary. For the past 12 years, he's run Alinta Energy, which has 1.2 million customers across Australia and owns and operates power stations as well. He says the market in the eastern states is in turmoil and there's little relief in sight.
The consequences of an asset not performing are quite severe. We missed a start at one of our units in Queensland this morning just through operational issue, which is not unforeseen or uncommon. You know, the consequence of that for not being there this morning when the price spiked is near enough to $1 million for us. That's the stakes that we're playing in now. It's high risk.
Spiralling prices for coal and gas have put a rocket under East Coast energy costs, which some claim are threatening to send major users to the wall. Jeff Dimery says an unwillingness by power companies to spend money on coal-fired plants, even for maintenance, is making matters worse.
Because we export gas and coal from Australia, we basically imported those supply problems. And as much as we want to move to being fully supplied by renewables in the marketplace, we still do rely very heavily on coal and gas on the east coast of Australia.
It's a different story in Western Australia. There, a domestic gas reservation policy, coal supplies not linked to export markets, and state control over much of the system are keeping prices low and stable.
There's a lot less volatility. The need for capacity is signaled well in advance, so you don't see the ups and downs that you have on the east coast. There's been some that have criticised and said that the market's not always efficient, but it's definitely more manageable. Perhaps you do give up a little bit of efficiency to maintain security of supply and stability, and I think that's a reasonable thing.
WA's Energy Minister Bill Johnston also points out Western Australia pays generators to be available when they're needed and imposes tighter price caps to reduce volatility.
And because of the capacity market combined with the price cap, we don't get those spikes in costs like on the East Coast.
Luke O'Callaghan is a partner at Perth-based law firm Lavin, specialising in energy. He says policy uncertainty lies behind many of the problems on the East Coast.
There's no way that you could look at what's happened over the last decade and say that that has helped. The kind of time horizon for investment in this infrastructure is reasonably long term. And so unless industry gets a sense from government that there is clarity, people are prepared to take leadership, then they simply won't invest and we'll end up with real challenges when it comes to making sure that there's reliable plant in the market.
Alinta Chief Executive Jeff Dimery says consumers in the eastern states have been let down for too long.
It's not okay to burden this back on the customer. I mean, my view is that between the politicians and the industry experts, we should have done a better job at planning for the future.
That's Alinta's Chief Executive, Jeff Dimery. Daniel Mercer reporting there. The Australian Council of Social Services calling for a $1,000 emergency energy debt relief payment for households on low fixed incomes. But the Federal Finance Minister, Katie Gallagher, isn't giving any hints that'll be possible.
We're putting together a budget for October, and of course, as the Treasurer has already foreshadowed, a cost of living lens will be placed over that budget, and we have to deal with the economic circumstances we face at the time. We make decisions based on that.
The Finance Minister, Katie Gallagher, speaking there on News Breakfast. Hot in the heels of the Reserve Bank's decision to lift official interest rates by half a percentage point to quell inflation comes a grim warning from the World Bank. It says the global economy is on the precipice of tipping into a 1970s-style stagflation. Here's North America correspondent Carrington Clark.
Appearing before the US Congress, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen was making it clear what her number one concern is.
We currently face macroeconomic challenges, including unacceptable levels of inflation.
And she's not the only one worrying. The World Bank is warning the global economy could be heading into a nightmare scenario of rising prices and weak growth. It's a toxic combination which caused major pain during the oil price shocks in the 1970s. The lead author of the new report which sounds the alarm is Ahan Kos. He says we may have once again entered a period of stagflation.
So you have weak growth is stagnating, and high inflation. It's a toxic mix when you think about having an economy that's weak, but at the same time, it has price pressures.
Globally, prices were already rising in recent years, driven by supply chain issues and increased demand for certain goods during the COVID-19 pandemic. And then Russia's invasion of Ukraine drastically increased the inflationary pressures and caused the cost of basic necessities to skyrocket.
With the invasion, we have a serious supply problem because Ukraine and Russia, and of course, Belarus as well, these are major producers of certain food commodities, and they are major producers, in the case of Russia, fertilizers.
Around the world, people are facing increasing prices, but they're also facing higher borrowing costs. In a progressively desperate attempt to slay inflation, central banks around the world are hiking interest rates. Yesterday, the Australian Reserve Bank hiked by 0.5%, and Mr. Kos says borrowers around the world need to brace themselves for more to come.
They need to raise interest rates. So the cost of borrowing is going to increase. What that means, a typical mortgage is going to cost more when you think about the interest rates people experienced over the past decade. I think the era of cheap money, low interest rate for the foreseeable future behind us.
The future is looking both more expensive and fraught with danger. This is Carrington Clark in Washington reporting for AM.
While carbon dioxide is the greenhouse gas most responsible for climate change, tackling methane emissions is also important if global warming is to be kept near 1.5 degrees Celsius compared with pre-industrial levels. Now, a new report by an international climate think tank has found methane gas emissions from some Australian coal mines could be double official estimates. Nathan Morris reports.
Australia's coal industry is booming, but so too are coal mine methane emissions.
What we found was that the methane leaking from Australian coal mines causes almost the double climate impact every year of all of Australia's cars. So, I mean, that's a really massive climate impact before we even start to think about the carbon dioxide emissions released from burning coal, for example.
Dr. Sabina Asan is a coal methane analyst at the UK-based climate think tank EMBER. It was commissioned by the environmental group Lock the Gate to analyse both Australian and internationally reported coal mine methane emissions.
What the government officially reports is based on what the coal mining companies and regulators report as methane emissions. What the International Energy Agency, the IEA, found was that they have estimated that Australia's methane emissions from coal mines is actually double that what is officially reported in Australia.
Dr. Asan says this is because the IEA is using new satellite data to check emissions from open pit mines, such as the Hale Creek coal mine near Mackay in central Queensland.
The coal mine that stands out to everyone is Hale Creek open pit mine, which has been found, I think, for 4 years in a row to be emitting, you know, almost 10 times as much as what is actually being reported by the mine.
A spokesperson for Hale Creek mine operator, Glencore, says the company adheres to national greenhouse gas reporting rules and that measurement standards are updated each year by the government. It also says the company has a 15% emissions target by 2026 and a 50% target by 2035.
All the operators, and probably the government, is getting away with doing things more simply than they can.
Professor Peter Rayner is an atmospheric scientist from the University of Melbourne. He says the discrepancy in methane recording is not necessarily deliberate.
So for me, the problem is not so much that people are trying to hide this, so much as that people aren't doing the little bit of work that we need to actually work out what's happening.
Methane is odourless and invisible, but it's a powerful greenhouse gas.
The difference between methane and carbon dioxide is that methane has a much stronger heating effect in the short term compared to carbon dioxide. So around 82 times that of CO2 over 20 years. However, it also has a shorter lifetime, which means that cutting the methane now will reduce global heating in the short term.
And as Professor Rayner points out, the CSIRO has developed technology to mitigate methane emissions.
They're significant pieces of engineering. But compared, for example, to re-engineering the total energy system, these are pretty cheap options. Methane, in a lot of cases, is a pretty low-hanging fruit for us.
University of Melbourne atmospheric scientist Professor Peter Rayner, ending that report from Nathan Morris. Major crisis is underway in regional Australia, with students being sent home to study unsupervised because of a dramatic shortage in teachers. The regions have always struggled to attract teachers, but COVID and the flu are compounding the problem. Here's National Regional Affairs reporter Lucy Barber.
Vern Hilditch has been a school principal for almost 30 years, but he's never seen anything like the teacher shortage in rural and regional areas right now.
One of my campuses had 28 staff away on any one day, which led to about 15 classes in each period having to be collapsed.
That meant almost half his staff at Wodonga Senior Secondary College in northern Victoria were sick or stuck at home because of COVID or the flu. Normally, he'd rely on relief and casual staff to fill the gaps, but they're in short supply too.
The vast majority of our replacement teachers are people who are retired teachers, and they are also very concerned about coming to school and also being in a situation whereby they may get infected.
It's a similar story across the border in Albury in New South Wales, where Trinity College principal Tony Schumach's Year 8, 9 and 10 students are studying at home without teacher supervision for a day each week.
We researched the best way possible to maintain the learning for all children. So going online or having a hybrid wasn't considered to be the best option.
He says there hasn't been backlash from parents.
Given the home learning that was in previous years, this is seen to be a very, very minor adjustments to our programs. We're hoping that this is only for this fortnight.
Other solutions being tried across the country include fly-in, fly-out teacher schemes and redeploying education bureaucrats from cities to teach in the regions. The Australian Education Union's president is Karina Haythorpe.
2 weeks ago, a principal in a country area told me that 18 of the 32 staff members were absent due to either COVID or flu. I mean, this is a major crisis.
Another option schools have is to hire university students not yet registered as teachers to take classes. Last year, the Queensland College of Teachers approved 363 applications from schools to employ student teachers. In the first 4 months of this year, there were already 341 approvals. 80% of those applications came from outside the metropolitan area.
I really think that we can't go back to pre-COVID ways of doing things.
Vern Hilditch says the sector needs longer-term solutions, and the best way to do that is to change the way the school week is structured.
And we have to get acceptance of the fact that somehow we have to be able to provide programs to some degree which are blended. You can't be in a situation where students are turning up to a school where teachers are stretched. There's very few of them there, and they're just going through the motions of childcare rather than teaching.
That's Wodonga Senior Secondary College Principal Vern Hilditch ending Lucy Barber's report. The Northern Territory is dealing with its worst flu outbreak in years as well, with one remote Indigenous community medically evacuating 2 residents a day. Local health workers say the symptoms people are experiencing are worse than COVID-19, but there's nowhere near the same level of resources to combat the outbreak. National Regional Health reporter Stephen Schubert has more.
Manangreeta on the north coast of Arnhem Land is a long way from a major hospital. It's the largest Indigenous community in the Northern Territory, 370 kilometres east of Darwin. For the last week, up to 2 people a day have been evacuated on medical flights due to a severe outbreak of influenza A.
In my mind, these are unprecedented numbers in volumes per day. You know, you're in the thick of it.
Jessica Gatti is the primary health manager at the local clinic. She says the number of people showing up looking for medical care has doubled.
It definitely has come a lot earlier and a lot harder than was anticipated. So we didn't have the opportunity to do a mass vaccination.
Is this worse than COVID-19 outbreaks?
Well, different. COVID-19, there had been so much pre-preparation going into it, so it's definitely worse in the sense that, it's a huge strain on the staffing and on the patients in that trying to see them all in a timely manner and effectively, and staff are just seeing far more patient loads than they normally would.
A spokesperson for the NT Health Department says there's been 2,162 cases recorded so far this flu season, and 140 people have been admitted to hospital. Last year, there were 76 cases of flu in the entire territory, and 5 patients were admitted. Manangreeta is not the only community struggling to contain outbreaks of influenza A.
For some unknown reason, it's arrived early, and it's caught our clinicians a little bit off guard.
John Patterson is the CEO of the Aboriginal Medical Services Alliance Northern Territory. While there have been no deaths from the flu in the NT this year, he says there have been outbreaks in Central Australia and other Indigenous communities too.
It's probably a little more severe than what they had, you know, with COVID. It's lasting a bit longer.
There were huge resources thrown at the Territory's COVID-19 outbreaks, but John Patterson says that came at the expense of other public health issues. In Manangreeta, clinic manager Jessica Gatti says she's been able to get more doses of Tamiflu, which helps treat symptoms, but the clinic desperately needs more help.
Ideally, we could get some additional resources to help with this tsunami that's happening at the moment.
A spokesperson for the NT Health Department says it has a plan in place to combat seasonal flu, including reconfiguring resources as required, but hasn't provided details of what that may involve.
Stephen Schubert. The Socceroos' World Cup dreams are still alive after a nerve-wracking win over the United Arab Emirates in Doha. The Australians defeated the UAE 2-1. The only thing standing between them and qualifying for the World Cup is a sudden death match against Peru next week. Our Middle East correspondent Alison Horn was watching the game in Doha. Alison, it was a bit of a topsy-turvy match. How did it unfold?
Well, Sabra, the first half was quite lacklustre. It seemed like both sides were being quite conservative, playing very defensive. I saw a few yawns in the crowd, which is never a good sign at a sporting game like this. But all of that changed as soon as Australia came back on for the second half. Straight out of the gates, bang, Jackson Irvine scored a goal. 55th minute it came for Australia. And you could immediately tell there was a change in the atmosphere. It felt so energised. Australians were up out of their seats. People here who were supporting the United Arab Emirates were booing and chanting and trying to provoke their team into reaction, and it worked. 3 minutes later, the UAE responded with an equaliser, and then it was a tense way to tussle back and forward, until finally Australia in the dying minutes scored that second goal that led us to the 2-1 victory that means Australia now gets to go and have one more shot at a qualifier for the World Cup finals later this year.
Now, you've indicated there were some Australians in the stands. How many?
Pretty limited, definitely outnumbered by the Emiratis. But look, they might have been a small crowd, but incredibly vocal. We were sitting in the stands above them and we could hear them loud and clear shouting the Aussie, 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 oi, oi, oi. And you could definitely tell it was lifting the spirits of the Socceroos, who were feeling, I would imagine, pretty down after what was, as I mentioned to you, a lackluster first half. You can only imagine the words that the coach, Graham Arnold, must have had to the team during the halftime break. And those Aussie fans have been rewarded now for coming all the way across to Doha to see this game. Here's what they've had to tell us.
Exhausted. What a game. What a game of football. Boys played well, got through in the end, and what a goal at the end as well.
Definitely worth the trip.
Absolutely. We'll see next week, but I think so far it's proving to have been a great decision to come here. I mean, what a game today. Incredible.
The boys played amazing, and yeah, we'll just have to wish them luck, and hopefully next week they win as well. It was very nerve-wracking, but yeah, just obviously keep calm, and I think we've got this.
So, Sabra, the Australians now have another do-or-die match against Peru next week. If they do make it through there, they are into the World Cup finals here in Qatar later this year. However, if they don't, it's game over for the World Cup campaign.
That's Middle East correspondent Alison Horn. That's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. The latest interest rate rise caught just about everyone off guard, coming in higher than expected at 0.5 percentage point. We haven't seen an increase that big for more than 20 years. Today, the ABC's business editor, Ian Verinder, on why the Reserve Bank is hitting us so hard and the cost of everything else is going up too. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.